God is completely equipped to take care of us. There is no way that we could ask for, that we could seek after, that we could even imagine a more able being to be our guide, to be our shepherd, to be our master, to be the one who is looking out for our well-being, both spiritually and physically. So now in verse 14, with whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Now nations, you want to know how great God is? The nations are counted as the drop of a bucket. You know, we've always heard this expression, no more than a drop. I always thought it said a drop in a bucket. But the quotation is a drop of a bucket. And what he means here is, you take a bucket down to the well and you draw it up out of the well, and when you get a bucket full of water, you get a little drop comes off, you know. A little water comes off the side of the bucket, a few drops. And we don't count that as anything. We don't even count, we wasted any water. It's just expected. The drops that fall off the side of the bucket. Well, he says that the nations are as a drop of a bucket. That's all the consequence that the things of God are compared to nations. And are counted as the small dust of the balance. It's as though you had a scale which measured something, and little dust collected on the scale. And that dust is so insignificant that it doesn't change the weight that the scale gives out. How many of us have weighed on scales and didn't bother to dust the dust off before we weighed ourselves, because that dust is so little, it doesn't even mount anything. Well, he says that these nations are counted as the small dust of the balance. That's how inconsequential the nations are. We think nations are great things, you know. Big, mighty institutions. Men give their lives for nations. But God says that they're just like the dust of the balance. And behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. Now the isles are probably the islands here. And he says that he takes up the isles. That is, these isles are caught up by God as though they're just a very little thing. And this little word little here means a small or fine thing or dust or chaff. So that if the isles are just like if God had a whirlwind, he could just take them and just catch them up in the wind and just treat them like dust or chaff or something that was small and little. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn. Now when he talks about Lebanon here, he's talking about the trees or the cedars of Lebanon, the mountains of Lebanon. Now those of us who've been to a place where they've got some mountains, like up in Canada or up in the Rocky Mountains, like in Colorado, and many, many other places these exist, where they have these mountains that are just covered with forests. I mean, there are trees everywhere on these mountains. Millions of acres of trees. Well, that's the way Lebanon was. Lebanon was a mountainous place, and it was covered with these trees. And so he says Lebanon is not sufficient to burn. That is, you could take all the trees growing in the mountains of Lebanon and stack them up for a burnt offering to God, and it wouldn't be sufficient to burn an offering to God. That's how great he is. Lebanon can't produce enough trees to burn an offering to him if he really was praised like he deserved to be praised. And he said, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All the beasts that lived in the mountains of Lebanon, if they were all put together, and all the trees used to burn these beasts with as an offering, he said, it wouldn't be enough. It was not sufficient for a burnt offering. Now, if we can just imagine how great that offering would be and how much God deserves to have it and how great it would be, what about the little paltry, miserably small, insignificant things that we do? We're not capable of giving God his true requirements of his greatness in doing service or sacrifice to him. The things that we do are so small that we couldn't even imagine doing the thing here that he described as being not sufficient. All nations before him are as nothing And they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. Now, all nations before him are as nothing. Let us remember that the number one obligation that we have in this life is to God. Not to the nation. Not to any man, any group of men, any organization. It's to God. Our number one obligation is to God. His law is the sovereign law. All the other laws are delegated by him. And the sovereign law always overrules the delegated laws. And so if we have ever in our life a need to make a choice between following God or following man's laws, let's always take God. Because all the nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. Now this word vanity means without form. It's the same word in Genesis 1 and 2 where he says the earth was void and without form. So they're less than nothing to God. So really, we're more important to God than nations are. And God should be more important to us than nations are. So in verse 18, he sums up by asking the question, to whom then will you liken God? Just who you're gonna compare God with? What or who or what force? What possibly can you compare to God? I can't even think of anything that I would want to stick up and hold up and compare it with God, to be like God. So to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare unto him? Now what likeness will you compare unto him? That is, what kind of a thing can you make, or can you see, or can you obtain that would be like him? And here now he's talking about idols. Israel, one of their greatest sins was the sin of idolatry. And of course, Isaiah wrote this before the captivity, but it was a prophecy about the captivity being over with, but he wrote it before the captivity. And the main reason they had to go into captivity was idolatry. And that's one lesson that they did learn from their captivity. When they got back from captivity, Israel wasn't guilty of idolatry anymore. I don't remember Christ even having to teach about idolatry. But we have it today. We have idolatry today in abundance. And it is so cleverly disguised that we sometimes are deceived and not realize that it is idolatry. There are all kinds of images. All kinds of images set up to represent some kind of holy being, some kind of supernatural force or God. There's no picture that would be a true likeness of God or of his son Jesus Christ. We're not intended to have anything like that. A cross. The symbol of the cross is an idolatrous symbol. It existed for centuries before Christ ever came. It was held by the paganistic world. The symbol of the cross was, and never are Christians to take the cross as a symbol. We wouldn't put up a cross anywhere. You see church buildings, you know, with a cross up on top of them. And you see them by their benches. They've got crosses on the end and crosses on the table up front. These crosses are nothing. They're idolatrous signs. They were in the Egyptian tombs centuries before Christ ever came. And never are we told to make the sign or to use the sign or a symbol of a cross. So just what are you going to take then? What likeness will you compare unto him? And now in verse 19 he begins to show the activity of the people, the things that the people did that really and truly were idolatry and were attempts to make a likeness of God. In verse 19 he says, the workman melteth a graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold and casteth silver chains. Now the workman here is somebody who could be described as an artificer, or a workman in iron, brass, stone, or wood, some kind of an artisan. He melteth. And the word melteth means that he actually casts. a graven image, and the word graven really means a molten image. He casts a molten image. Oh, this was something done thousands of years now before modern times. They would get them a cast, and they would pour it full of some kind of metal and mold or cast an image. The workman cast an image, he says. And the goldsmith, and this word goldsmith is some kind of a worker in metals, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold. After they get this image all cast, then he spreads it over with gold, maybe putting very, very much value into it by decking it and ornamenting it. Spreadeth it over with gold, and casteth the silver chains. That is, they make chains out of silver used to ornament the idol with. This is the trade of idol making he's talking about, and it was a very prosperous trade. It was practiced very much. And any time you've got people who are going to worship and buy and use these idols, you're going to have people who make them for them. And so he's describing what the people were doing just after he asked the question, for what likeness will you compare unto him? Now today we have to be careful that we do not allow these images to hold any kind of a significance for us, that we do not use them in any way that could be misconstrued or misunderstood as putting any kind of a spiritual significance upon them. Just as the cross and the sign of the cross has no meaning to us, neither do all these statues. In the Catholic Church, they've got a statue over there at St. Peter's Basilica, I understand, which is the head church of modern Roman Catholicism. That is supposed to be a statue of the Apostle Peter. But this statue was originally an idolatrous statue made to represent an idol, an idolatrous god, that then the Catholic Church took and suddenly declared it was a statue of Peter. And they have kissed the feet of this statue so much until they've worn away part of his toes. The Pope kisses it. Now this is people today who claim to be highly religious and highly powerful people. And so we cannot afford to allow these traditions of man creep into the church. All of the practice of Christmas comes from idolatry, from paganism, and it all existed thousands of years before Christ. The mother and child features of a virgin giving birth to a child, this was in religious mythology thousands of years before Christ, and this virgin mother, this mother of God was worshipped, was idolized, was adored, and then whenever the Catholics came along and borrowed this stuff from paganism, they just took it and put it right into the church and started worshiping Mary as the Virgin Mother and praying to God through Mary and saying that you could get a lot more favors if you go through Mary because Mary has more influence over them than we do, you know, that type of thing. Terrible doctrines, but still it's all a part of this idolatry. And if we allow this heathenistic and idolatrous doctrine to creep into our midst and to become a part of us, then we're going to be guilty of this. I've seen people in the apostate church die in the hospital. I've had several of them to die, and they would deck their bed with crosses that have images of Christ hanging from a cross, that have pictures of something that's supposed to look like an angel or something, and just have this pinned and decked all around the bed, just filled with idolatry, as though it was going to have anything to do with the salvation of their soul or with helping them in their hour of death. Well, in the 20th verse, he describes a little different situation. This 19th verse is a rich, costly idol. Now, in the 20th verse, he says, "He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation," and the word oblation means an offering or a rich gift, so the one that's so poor that he doesn't have any rich gift or no offering to give like the rich had, he chooseth a tree that will not rot. Now, a tree that will not rot in this day and time was probably a cedar or a cypress or an oak tree. "He seeketh unto him a cunning workman." A cunning workman is a wise workman. It's one who is knowledgeable. to prepare a carved or graven image that shall not be moved. So if he can't make a molten image that's covered with gold and decked with silver chains, then he looks out a tree that won't rot, one that's the very best wood. He gets a good workman. He has him to carve him an image out of this. And he prepares a carved image or a graven image that will not be moved. That is, the word moved here means it's going to be permanent. Now, this is a poor idol, the idol that a poor man would make. And everybody had to have an idol, it seems. Something that they could look upon and place a little bit of significance on. If you weren't rich and couldn't have a rich one, well, you made yourself a poor one. Or got somebody to make you a poor one. Make one out of wood. But you picked the good wood. You picked the good wood that wouldn't rot. And you fixed this idol that would not be moved. And the word moved means that he's made permanent. Now, it was probably permanent from the standpoint that it wouldn't rot. But it was also made permanent probably from the standpoint that this man who went to all this trouble to make this idol did not intend to change his worship. He intended to stay with this idol from now on. So this was a poor idol. He compares what the rich do and what the poor do. And then he says in verse 21, have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? That is what he's saying here is there is no excuse for not knowing the true, living, powerful God. There's no excuse for it. Haven't you known from the very beginning, from the very creation of the earth, that there's a true God and there's a living God? In Romans 1, beginning with the 18th verse, Paul alludes to this very same fact, and I'd like to turn and read that to get a broader picture of this. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. In other words, God has shown man, regardless of how wicked it is, God has shown man that there is a God. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Now, man can look and see that there's about to be some kind of a creation. There's some kind of a power behind this universe that he's not able to fathom what it truly is. Something has put these stars into orbit. Something has created all of this life that we have here. It's clearly seen from the very creation, if man will just look. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and the foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like the corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. So that's what Isaiah is talking about. They build these images. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness, through the lust of their own heart, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. So Paul's talking about this same thing there in Romans. So Isaiah says, have you not known? Have you not heard? And that's just like the attitude we could have today as we see these people who are going around making the sign of the cross and who are worshiping these little dolls and these idols and these pictures on the walls and these images that they've got, and they bow down to them and they serve them and they serve man. We could ask them, well, don't you know? Haven't you heard? There's a God. There's a true and living God. You don't have to serve these things, these idols of stick and stone. Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth, or rather from the very creation of the earth? What about this God? It is He that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. God sits on the circle of the earth. Now this circle of the earth would mean the roundness of the earth. Some of the commentators say that this doesn't have reference to the fact that the earth is round, but to me, this is strong evidence that way back in Isaiah, he taught that the earth was round. He sits on the circle of the earth. God sits. As you look at this, the sky and see that it makes a curve and disappears, He's sitting on the circle or the curve of the earth. That's That's one image that we could think of when we think of God. And the inhabitants thereof, that is those of us who live on this earth, the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. They're like a bunch of locusts. The word grasshoppers here means locusts. And if you had a swarm of those locusts that were so common in the East at the time this was written, if you had a swarm of those locusts all congregate in one place, you'd just see a moving mass of living material crawling over each other and moving around, and you wouldn't know what they were up to or any good purpose of anything that they're doing, and you know that whatever they're doing is going to come to an end in a short time because they're so temporary. And that's how we are. We're just like a bunch of grasshoppers in the sight of God. Our little plans, the things that are so great to us, that are so important to us, the things that we'll forsake God for, these things are as nothing. And he goes on and describes him. Not only is it he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, but he says, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. Now this word curtain here means a thin canopy. And it maybe is an allusion to the houses that they built in this day and time in which this was written, in which they'd have a courtyard, and the house would encircle the courtyard, and the courtyard was open so that you could get light and sun and fresh air from the courtyard, but yet you were protected from the outside vision of people. And so some people would take this courtyard and put a tent over it and shelter it, make a shade there. And so he says that God, who has he's created this earth, and so he's the one that's taken the heavens, and he stretched them out like a curtain or like a tent over, or like a canopy over the earth. He just stretched them out over the earth, like we would put a canopy over to make ourselves a shade. That's what God's put over the earth for us. And spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. He spread them out and encircled them then around us, just like you're living in a tent. So that as we look upon this universe, the sky, the firmament up above, it's the great tent that God has spread for us. That's the description Isaiah gives of it. This is the God. It's he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. He's the one that we look like a bunch of grasshoppers to. He's the one that's taken the heavens and spread them out like a canopy and stretched it out like a tent. He's the one, verse 23, that bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth his vanity. He brings the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth his vanity. Now, as we think of this, the princes and the judges, they're the rulers of the earth. And let us here once again realize that all of these powers that are upon the earth, all of these powers are as nothing in the sight of God. He raises up kings and he destroys kings. He uses nation against nation to get his way done. As Isaiah talked back earlier of the troubles that Israel had, and whenever they were threatened by the mighty Assyrian army, he says, I'm just using the Assyrian army like a tool. Just like the workman who'd pick up an axe, or the farmer who'd pick up a hoe. It's just a tool for me. This mighty nation, just a tool to get things done like I want them done. Another place he says that he hissed and called the nations like a beekeeper would give out the hiss and call the bees to come in. He called the nations in to do what he wanted them to do. He lets them have wars. He even makes them have wars to get things going like he wants it to go, to bring about his will. And so the best thing we can do is to try to see what God wants. What is God's will? And let his will be. We don't try to change it. We don't try to interfere with it. We don't try to make the decision for him. You'd have no way of knowing who to vote for president. No way you could know who God wants to be president. He'd have to give you a miraculous revelation for you to know. And if he did that, then he'd have to do it to every member of the church. And every member of the church would have to know who they're going to vote for. And if one person voted for the wrong man, he'd be committing a sin. How would you have known back whenever Nixon was running against McGovern for president? How would you know who God wanted for president? Did he want Nixon? If he wanted Nixon, he only wanted him for a short time. When he got through with Nixon, he got him out of there. Put somebody else in his place. You had no way of knowing that. You couldn't have participated in that in any way. Let God have his way. The princes, he said, he brings to nothing. Nixon won that election with the greatest landslide of anybody ever, I suppose. He defeated McGovern as hard as anybody could ever be defeated, and he was at his very height. And yet in a year or two, Nixon was nothing. He was the very scum of the political force in this nation. He bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. The judges. They get their power from the rulers, and in most cases, the judges are the rulers. But even in this country where we have judges, the county judge, probably there's nobody around that has any more power than a county judge. He can make people's lives one way or another just at the little whim. He just passed a judgment on them. Make them guilty or innocent. Make them go to jail or not go to jail. Make them lose a child. Give the child to this one and take it away from that one. Not let this one have any visiting rights. All these things. He's powerful. But in the eyes of God, he says, the judges of the earth are his vanity. And so as we look to those powerful things that we know as rulers and judges and nations, he says in verse 24, yea, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. And he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. In other words, they're not going to be permanent, ever-growing things on this earth. They'll not be planted, they'll not be sown, they'll not take root in the earth. They're going to just be temporary. And as you look back, you know, how far back can you trace any royal family? They don't have long abiding roots. They change, they turn over, they change to a different dynasty even. They'll not be planted. They'll not take root. But yet he said of Jesus now, and his people, his seed, back in Isaiah the 11th chapter, let me just turn and read that first verse. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. It was just like an old tree stump there that had been there for a long time, and then suddenly out of that old, looking like a dead tree stump, there came forth a rod, a shoot, a branch grew up out of it. And that was the branch then that would ultimately then become the Savior. Well, these kings are not going to be like that. So in verse 25 he says, to whom then will you liken me? Who are you going to make me like? Or shall I be equal? Saith the Holy One. Who can you compare me with? There is no being that we can ever imagine that we could compare the Lord with. Man in all of his fables has not been able to imagine a being as powerful as the one described here in this chapter. Measured out the water in the cup of his hand. Take the span of his hand and encompass the heavens. Weigh the mountains and the hills. Weigh all the dust of the earth. As powerful as God is, sitting there upon the curve of the earth, the circle of the earth, looking down on man like a bunch of grasshoppers, spreading out the heaven like a canopy, making a tent over the earth with it. We can't imagine him. And as he talks about these nations in verse 24, and he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. Now, we've been out in the field, I'm sure, in this country, all of us who raised on the farm, and we see a little whirlwind come over yonder, and it blows for about 5 or 10 minutes, and it just sucks up the dust and takes it with it. But they claim that in this desert country, where close to where Isaiah was writing this from, that the whirlwinds there are vicious whirlwinds. And they'll start of a morning, and they'll blow up the dust of the desert, and it makes such a cloud of dust until it's fearsome that you're afraid to get caught in one of those whirlwinds. But that's the way the Lord treats the princes and the judges of the earth. He makes them as nothing. He makes them as vanity. Just a few short years ago, we were so afraid of the great power of Hitler, and of Mussolini, and of Stalin, and of Hirohito. Now, we don't even think about them. They're nothing. As nothing. They don't even have any descendants. They don't have anybody that gives them any kind of credit even today, as far as I know. We're certainly not afraid of them. God takes them like a horse.